If you're judging where we are in the great arc of time by how we measure up with the movies, we live in the future. Of course, we don't live in space yet, which seems crucial, but there are plans in the works to figure out how it's gonna be when and if we do. So, obviously, we're gonna need science for that, and engineering and math. But when humans go someplace new, there is something else we always need. We need laws. A local lawyer is making a name for himself in space law. He has inadvertently started carving out this weird niche dealing specifically with objects from space. His name is Chris McHugh, and he's here with me now on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Chris McHugh, good morning.
Oh, good morning. So happy to be here.
So we are going to get into the big questions about space law in a minute, but I want to start with how you got into it. Your business card does not say space lawyer. So what do you normally do?
It does not. Normally, I am a pretty mundane commercial litigator, and I do stuff that nobody would care about except the parties that are involved in the lawsuit. Just very normal commercial business litigation.
But then one day you got a call from someone with a crazy story, if I understand this right, about a bag. Can you tell that story?
Sure, I'll try. So I got a call one afternoon from a woman named Nancy Carlson, and she did. She had an unbelievable story that she had found online for sale the Apollo 11 contingency lunar sample bag, which I didn't quite know what that was at the time,
yeah.
But that's a big deal.
What is it? What lunar contingency sample bag?
So to put it kind of in summary, it is the bag that Neil Armstrong used to put the first moon rocks in.
Whoa.
Yeah, and it was lost by NASA, and she found
Whoops. It. how did she know that she had found that? I mean, that can't be what it was on sale as, was it?
No, it had been forgotten about, and it had been put up for auction accidentally by the United States government. She bought it, not really knowing what it was, but sort of suspecting that it might be something huge. Did some research, got more suspicious, sent it to NASA, and NASA was obviously skeptical. But they agreed to check into it, and then wrote back to her and said, yes, this is the contingency bag. It is a national treasure, and we are not going to give it back to you.
So what happens then? She calls you, obviously, but what do you – I mean, as a lawyer, what's going through your mind around this? Because is there, like, a lot of precedent involving objects that have traveled to space?
No. There's none. Our case was the first. So what was going through my head is this isn't true at first. This can't be real. But once I got the documents, it was very clear to me that exactly what had happened. It was obvious. So I called her back. I said I would love to be a part of this case. And then we just decided to start arguing our case to the court on why this was her bag. She bought it fair and square, and the government couldn't take it back. They had no reason to.
Well, so can I play devil's advocate here? I'm sure you're used to arguing your point
sure.
against some serious pushback. The idea that NASA's bad for losing this thing, I will say, but the idea that it is a national treasure is also hard to argue with, and the idea that it should reside in someone's, like, closet or something when once there are a lot of things that once they're discovered they end up, you know, in a museum or just in some special place where it can be shared by humanity.
Sure. And we never tried to downplay the importance, the historical importance of this. I never argued that this wasn't a national treasure. I think it is. It's probably one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And that's what NASA argued, what you just said. But the counterargument to that is that the government in our country should be treated like anybody else. And if they sell something, then they should be held to that. And that Nancy bought this fair and square. It was a deal. And that's the way it should work. The government shouldn't get special treatment.
Does she want to continue owning it or does she want to sell it, you know, based on a price that would be based on what it is now known to be, which right. is a bag with space dust in it.
Right. So actually, she did sell it. So she bought it for $995, and two summers ago, it sold at Sotheby's in New York for $1.8 million.
Yeah, so big difference.
Yeah, big return.
So what? Any knowledge of what happens to it now? Because,
no.
I mean, the idea that this is going to remain in private property seems unlikely to me, because what does a person want with just having a bag of space dust?
Well, I don't know. I don't have 1.8 million, so I don't run in those circles. But it is an amazing object, and I have a feeling.
Have you seen it?
I have.
What does it look like?
So it looks kind of like a jumper cable bag is the best way I could describe it. You know, like you put your jumper cables in, but it's made of beta cloth, so it's round, and it's made of beta cloth, which is a astronaut suit cloth, what they make astronaut suits out of. And it has a zipper on the top, and it's got some embroidered a label on it, and some serial numbers and part numbers on it. But it's a very basic beta cloth bag. It's about 14 inches in diameter, and it had a very simple purpose. It was Neil Armstrong was to unzip it, reach down, pick up a moon rock, put it in, zip it up, and take it back to the lunar lander.
So the rock found its way out of the bag, and then the bag, someone just...
Yeah. So in the 1970s, NASA took a lot of the Apollo mission stuff and they sent it to the Smithsonian. This was missed. And it apparently just sat in the corner for decades until it landed in the private collection of a guy named Max Airy. Max Airy was convicted of some federal crimes. And as a result of that case, the bag and his entire private collection was forfeited to the government, which then unknowingly sold that bag on the open market.
I have to say, I just moved, and this is making me feel so much better about like the shirts I forgot I had.
Well, it's an incredible, it is an unbelievable story. And I didn't really appreciate the value or the historical significance of this bag until I really looked into it. But it is like the holy grail of space artifacts. And when Nancy first contacted NASA, they were pretty incredulous. They did not believe her.
Well, I'm sure people contact them all the time with like, I have Neil Armstrong's shoe or something like that.
Yeah, this would be like contacting the Louvre and saying you have the Mona Lisa in your closet. And they just didn't believe her. But what they did was they were able to get samples of lunar dust from the bottom. And they were able to trace those samples back to, actually to the Sea of Tranquility. And that was just, confirmed it, that had to be Apollo 11.
You know, when I think about just big questions in law, I think of that as questions about justice, and obviously there have to be like rules that make transactions fair. But then there's this other piece of it, like I guess the law does not resolve whatever moral obligation someone might feel to like give this bag to humanity.
Sure. And luckily I don't really deal with moral obligations. It's not my job. That's somebody else's.
Insert lawyer joke here.
Yeah, exactly. But it was a case that was absolutely new. It was up in the air and we didn't know how it was going to turn out. And in fact, when I had to present the case to my partners in order to take it, and to a person, they all said I was going to lose.
Why do you think that didn't turn out to be true?
I think the judge looked at the case and decided
person versus NASA.
Yeah, it was a little bit of an underdog David versus Goliath type thing, and I think Judge Martin decided that he needed to treat NASA under the law as it existed, like any other person.
Well, so I also you're working on another space artifact case right now.
Yeah, just as weird. I had another call.
Now you're the guy.
I guess. I have the most experience with one case. So Yes, I had a call. A woman named Laura Chico called and said that she had been gifted by Neil Armstrong a vial of lunar dust when she was 10 years old.
Okay. Did she elaborate on the circumstances?
Yeah, but she doesn't know a whole lot.
Because she was 10.
She was 10, and it didn't mean much to her at the time. But her father was friends with Neil Armstrong. And out of that relationship came this gift. And I was able to test the dust that she gave me. It is real. It is lunar dust. And she had with it a signed, the back of her father's business card was signed, Neil Armstrong, Good Luck, Laura. And I sent that off and it's authentic. So it looks real.
So what happens with that? Is that seems like it would be less of a... of an issue because it didn't once belong to NASA.
Well, NASA thinks it did.
Oh.
NASA's position is that no lunar material can be owned by a private person, that it all belongs to them. And any lunar material in private hands is stolen property. So there is a lawsuit going on right now in the same jurisdiction in Wichita, Kansas, to decide that issue. We've sued NASA because we think that's wrong. We think that that was a gift to Laura, and she should be able to keep it.
But the question here is who owns the moon, basically, because, you know, like I've read a children's book about this where it's like the cat wants to know who owns the moon and all the animals think they own the moon. And then, like, the big moral of this story for probably three-year-olds is that nobody owns the moon.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. All I know is that when someone gives you something under the law, under normal circumstances, you own it. And so I don't know why this should be any different.
Unless it wasn't theirs to begin with. And I guess you could make the argument that if Neil Armstrong was working for NASA and it was his assignment to go get that dust, and instead of giving it to NASA, he gave it to some 10-year-old, then that is tricky, right?
Yeah.
Can you admit it?
I would admit it, but I think it's very difficult to impugn Neil Armstrong's character. I don't know anyone who would be willing to do that.
Well, no, that's not what I was trying to do. But
I understand. And that's really what NASA would have to argue in order to get this dust back. And I just don't know that they're willing to say that because I don't think it's true.
Really? Because like without impugning my character, if I sort of out of the goodness of my heart took some random mug from KCUR that says KCUR on it and was like, you know what, I know someone who would really like this, and just gave it to them, not thinking anything like I've just stolen from my employer. But then like you don't have to impugn my character to think that that mug still belongs to KCUR.
Well, the law as I read it is the only thing that can break title in the chain is a thief. So it's pretty clear. It can't just be some type of misunderstanding.
Man. Well, I guess like the big question I have is whether this is something you expect to start coming up more as future people start going to space and more spacecrafts go out into the universe. I mean, where do you think space law may be headed beyond old-timey artifacts traced back to Neil Armstrong?
I'm really excited to see where it goes. I think there are all kinds of great questions, and I'm really glad you started off by saying that we need lawyers because that's not a very common perception. But
well, yeah, settling a land usually does involve, like, what are the rules about this?
Right, exactly. And it's no different in space. It's just the next step. And we'll work all that out. None of it is set out really yet. There are some treaties on what you can't do, but those are going to have to be.
There could be some one-eyed pink monster who thinks he owns space.
Well, he probably has the ability to enforce that claim, and so I don't know the lawyer's going to do you too much good.
What big questions do you find yourself asking, like deep philosophical questions? Do you do that? I mean, I know it's not what you do necessarily in court, but do you do that in your quiet moments?
Sure. And if you look at the decision that Judge Martin gave on the lunar bag, at the very end, he goes into it. He talks about the value of the bag and how the value is derived from the bravery, the courage, the sacrifice, and the ingenuity of Americans. and that it's questionable what to do with this bag, whether it should be in private hands. And so, of course, we think about those things.
That it's just a hard philosophical question.
It's just something that I get to think about, and then I don't have to decide.
Chris McHugh is a Kansas City lawyer with the firm Siegfried Bingham. He's represented more than one client on cases involving ownership of objects that come from space, and we spoke to him in January. Up next on Central Standard, we are headed back to Earth, and we're going from the future to the past with foods Mark Twain liked. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. How do you cook a prairie chicken in 1877? The first step is to cut out all the shot. Then you gotta clean that bird with baking soda and sew it back up with a cotton thread. I learned that while reading a book on the food Mark Twain dreamed of while homesick in Europe. There's a tendency today to think of Europe's culinary traditions as superior to our own, but Mark Twain, who dined on prairie chickens and porterhouse steaks, peach cobbler, and Saratoga potatoes, found German food, and I quote, insipid. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'd like to welcome Andrew Beers to the show. He's the author of Twain's Feast, Searching for America's Lost Foods in the Footsteps of Samuel Clemens, which has recently inspired a new podcast with comedian Nick Offerman. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Gina. Thanks so much for having me.
It is super funny to me how Mark Twain uses the word insipid to describe European food.
I know, it's really not what you expect. But, you know, when he was traveling around Europe in 1878 and 9, he was with his family. And so most of the time, he found himself limited to eating in hotels, which you kind of think about yourself being if you could only eat in airports. It was really second tier, kind of drab, dry food. And so that's what he got real sick of it after traveling around for about 18 months.
Yeah, you list these German phrases he wants to master, and they're all just different ways to insult food, like this tea isn't good, this coffee isn't good, this bread seems old. Isn't there a curious smell about? And isn't that something in the butter?
Yeah, he decided to start learning those phrases very, very early on. He knew that he was in bad shape for this trip.
But what fascinates me about that is it turns out that a lot of the accepted wisdom about who makes real food and who's got the fake stuff, it turns that on its head when you think about how we tend to think of European food versus American food. I mean, he calls it like imposter food in Europe.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, Twain knew America really, really well. He was one of the great travelers of his day. And so when he sits down towards the end of this trip in Europe, in Vienna, to write kind of a fantasy menu, you know, you can feel him drawing on his travels and going into the depths that American food had to offer at the time. So, you know, he starts off saying, like, look, I want this. I'm done with European food. I want this meal ready for me when I get off the steamer home in 6 months, you know, a small private affair all to myself. But he riffs for like 85, 100 items, something like that, depending on how you count. And yeah, I mean, it's spectacular. I mean, it's radishes, frogs, baked apples, porterhouse steak, roast turkey, cranberries, all sorts of American pastry, he says.
You know what? Can I pause at baked apples? Because you know what? I grew up eating baked apples, but I have not known a lot of other people who are like, you know what says America in the wintertime to me? Baked apples.
Yeah. A lot of these foods came from his memories of growing up on his uncle's farm. And so you can kind of look back to his days in Missouri and, you know, see what the things were that kind of lodged in his memory. And I think baked apples was among that.
Well, let's back up. I mean, so Mark Twain was living abroad, as you've said. He wrote A Tramp Abroad, which is like a travel memoir. And there is this part, as you've said, where he's imagining a perfect American feast in this very classic homesick traveler kind of way. He makes this long list of foods he's dying to eat. So here you are, though, a guy living in California in the 21st century. You read this and think, I'm going to use this list to make a Mark Twain-inspired breakfast.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing is, the breakfast that he describes, that, you know, he says in, when he's in Europe, he's eating a dry piece of bread and maybe some imposter butter because it hasn't been properly salted and all that kind of thing.
The continental breakfast.
Exactly. Exactly. And then he says the perfect American breakfast is you have to imagine an angel sweeping down out of a better land and setting down before you a porterhouse steak with a perfect gravy and with biscuits and with buttermilk cakes with real maple syrup and with a perfect cup of American coffee with the cream of froth on top. And so, yeah, to start off, I tried to reproduce that as well as I could. And I see where he was coming from. It was pretty good.
So, okay, let's talk about the different elements. I know this was a long time ago now for you, this breakfast, but it left an impression on me, and I think it really sets up why you were so inspired that you kept going with recreating these items from this list. So let's start with the steak itself. I mean, you spent like a week at least just hunting down the right ingredients for your breakfast. And the steak was supposed to be what, an inch and a half thick?
Exactly, an inch and a half thick porterhouse. And, you know, I didn't want to just go out and get any steak. I wanted to reproduce the flavors that he had as closely as possible. And so to do that, you know, now most of our beef is corn-fed. And that's got a particular flavor. It's got a particular finishing. But for him, it almost would have certainly been grass-fed, maybe corn-finished. But it would have eaten grass through its whole life. And then also it would have been dry-aged instead of wet-aged. We've changed the whole aging process where, you know, it's faster. You have to use less the storage facilities for less time. So anything that's quicker, that equals money in the preparation process for a steak. So I wanted to find something that was grass fed, dry aged, an inch and a half thick. You know, they're out there, but you sometimes have to do some work trying to track this stuff down.
So you get that steak, and then you've got to make some biscuits. Anything to share about the biscuits?
You know, not really on the biscuits, I don't think. I used a recipe that was given to me when I used to be in archaeology, and I was working on a plantation in Virginia. And so that just felt like on that, I was more trying to draw on the idea that Twain had drawn on his own memories, you know, kind of tastes that he recalled from his own life. And so I was trying to kind of reproduce that feeling more than the actual flavor.
Okay. So then the pieces of the breakfast beyond the steak that really were intriguing to me, the coffee and cream, which go together, of course. But if you travel with Americans in Europe, a lot, the difference between American coffee and European coffee is usually observed still today. However, again, usually the American coffee is what gets the snub. And like you hear about like, oh, this real full fat cream of Europe. But Mark Twain has the opposite issue.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, he saw that in hotels, they were mostly watering the coffee down. And he referred to the cream as being baptized because there was so much water in it. Like you'd pour water over the cream. So it was just, again, it was trying to keep things very cheap and kind of efficient. You're just feeding travelers. And he recalled, you know, some of the great coffee that he'd had in New York or maybe Chicago, his travels around the country, San Francisco, certainly, and especially the cream. That was the thing that was maybe a little bit trickier to track down because his cream would have been always and forever raw. So it hadn't been pasteurized, and so it didn't have this kind of like just slightly burnt flavor that isn't detectable to our tastes anymore, really. We're so used to it. And that's kind of what we think milk should taste like. But if you have raw cream, it's got a sweetness and a richness and kind of a forward flavor to it.
You tracked this down, but raw cream is not legal to sell in all states. And then when it is legal, it's expensive and it's like a delicacy. Can you tell me about was this the first raw cream you had tasted?
It was definitely. And you're right. I think it's illegal in 37 states. I'm forgetting the exact number. But you can't get it everywhere. And fortunately, I live close to a market that actually carries it. But it's, you know, it's $15 for half a pint or something. It's incredibly expensive.
Worth it?
Once or twice. I don't stock my refrigerator with it, but it was definitely worth it that day.
And then the syrup is you cheated because you disagreed with Mark Twain's assessment of what makes a good American syrup.
Well, I went with dark maple syrup, right? And he says he wants clear maple syrup. And I really love the richness of a darker maple syrup. You know, there's kind of all different levels of flair where maybe it tastes a little bit floral. Maybe there's a buttery taste to it. And he said clear. But then this is something where in following Twain, you'd realize that sometimes there was a reason behind what he said. So for him, when you used to make syrup out of doors with, you know, fires going and ashes and cinders and all that kind of thing, saying clear maple syrup for him, I think, might have just meant clean, you know, transparent, like it was done well and you didn't have this kind of like sooty, ashy insertion to it. And so looking back on it, I actually think that maybe I was more in line with what he wanted.
Okay, so I just want to say this is not your first cooking project inspired by literature. And that is curious to me. When you're reading along, any mention of food seems to stop you in your tracks. What do you think is going on there?
That's a good question. And I don't know that I have a great answer for that. It's just always been true. I was an incredibly picky eater as a kid. And I think that the way that I got into being a more exploratory reader was – or eater, rather, was through reading. You know, kind of reading people eating about exotic things or enjoying great meals kind of got me excited about trying things in the way that maybe like a travelogue would get you excited about going to visit a different place.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, I mean, I don't know you, we have not met, but it does seem from reading this book like your brain is just wired in this way that puts food in the same place as literature, like they live in the same part of your imagination.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's true. I mean, they're both ways that of kind of marking out your life. I mean, I think that all of us, if we're lucky enough, have recollections of a particular book that might have changed our life or kind of helped us to think about the world in a different way. And that often is very situated for people. Like, oh yeah, I read that this one summer where I was at home or I was on vacation or something like that. And I think food occupies some of the same place. You know, where these are things that you experience and then kind of carry the memory of, and they help to mark out the way you see things from then on.
Okay, so you make this breakfast. It's got steak and biscuits and coffee and frothy cream and maple syrup, and you'd think that that would have satisfied your personal need to make Mark Twain's favorite foods, but it did not. It became this long-term obsession, which then launched you next step onto a trip to Illinois to observe prairie chickens at like sunrise or something crazy like that. And there is a lot to find strange about that life choice on your part. But I am going to focus on the fact that you went to Illinois, not Missouri. Mark Twain ate prairie chicken as a child in Missouri.
Well, he did, but he specified on his menu prairie hens from Illinois. And that was actually the thing that really helped the book kind of come together for me and help me realize what it was I was looking at. Because, you know, like you said, I'm reading this stuff and I tend to just stop short. And so I have this whole long menu of Mark Twain's. And I was thinking, okay, well, you know, maybe a cookbook. It'll be – I'll have a little recipe from a period – from, you know, historical recipes and say kind of, well, this is how it would have been cooked, a little introductory couple lines. But then prairie hens from Illinois, I mean – okay, if you're from that area, maybe you've grown up knowing about prairie hens, but I'd never even heard of one. And so I'm kind of like, what's
a
prairie
hen? You're from the East Coast, right?
I'm from the East Coast. I'm from Connecticut and live in California now. And so I'm going, what's a prairie hen and why do they have to be from Illinois? And looking into it, I realized that when Mark Twain was a kid, there were like three or four times as many prairie hens in Illinois right across the river from Hannibal as ever before or ever since. There were like 14 million prairie hens in Illinois. They were everywhere and they were huge and fat. And the reason was that John Deere invented the plow that could effectively break the prairie just 2 years after Twain was born. So, you know, before Twain was born, it's like you just have kind of unbroken prairie in Illinois. And then right during his youth, people are coming in with these relatively inexpensive plows and making this checkerboard of corn and grass. So the prairie hens still have habitat. They still have wild grassland. But they also have this incredible food source. They've got corn everywhere. And so there's tons of these birds. And I think that that was just so dramatic for him. I mean, if you've heard prairie hens in the morning when they're booming at dawn using their throat sacs, they can be heard for miles. And so I kind of like to think of him hearing that from across the river where there would have been more grasslands running and right up to the Mississippi.
That is something that you heard on this trip you took.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's this deep ululation. You know, you can go out to Prairie Ridge Wildlife Area and listen to it. And to me, I mean, it just sounded so exotic and bizarre. I mean, one of the people I was with in the blind said, this doesn't even sound like America. And I know what she was saying. But that was such a striking way.
But it would if you lived in Illinois, probably.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, back then, it wouldn't have just... It would have been the inescapable sound of that part of America. There would have been no way to get away from it. Now you have to travel to hear that and to experience that.
There's a passage about the native foods of Missouri that I'd really like you to read. And I want to clarify, this is Mark Twain's writing about the native foods of Missouri. He's remembering the foods of his childhood, and you observe that it's like a song or a prayer or something, the way it's written.
Absolutely, absolutely. So this is from when he was growing up. In Hannibal, he would go out to his uncle John Quarles' prairie farm in Florida, Missouri, which was situated right between the prairie and the forest. And so, yeah, here it is. I can call back the prairie and its loneliness and peace, and a vast hawk hanging motionless in the sky, with his wings spread wide and the blue of the vault showing through the fringe of their end feathers. I can see the blue clusters of wild grapes hanging among the foliage of the saplings, and I remember the taste of them and the smell. I know how the wild blackberries looked and how they tasted, and the same with the pawpaws, the hazelnuts, and the persimmons. And I can feel the thumping rain upon my head of hickory nuts and walnuts when we were out in the frosty dawn to scramble for them with the pigs. I know the taste of maple sap and when to gather it. I know how a prize watermelon looks when it is sunning its fat rotundity among pumpkin vines and cymbalins. I know the look of green apples and peaches and pears on the trees, and I know how entertaining they are when they are inside of a person. I know how ripe ones look when they are piled in pyramids under the trees, and how pretty they are and how vivid the colors. I know the look of an apple that is roasting and sizzling on a hearth on a winter's evening. And I know the comfort that comes of eating it hot, along with some sugar and a drench of cream.
Andrew Beers, now that you have written this book about food in Mark Twain's America, Twain's Feast, where you researched his favorite foods and recreated several of the dishes like as faithfully as possible, is there something that you think you understand about the food of the prairie or the food of Missouri that even those of us who live here today may not know or get?
You know, the thing that came across no matter where I was is just how rooted in place food used to be. So that was certainly true for Missouri as much as anywhere in the world where you're talking about prairie hens. And then also just, you know, you feel from that passage that I just read how much it wasn't just a meal that he would eat. It was a place that he experienced through food. And so that really became a reality for me through this while I was following Twain. So it's, you know, the deep rootedness of prairie hens in Missouri, of oysters in San Francisco Bay, of terrapin in Maryland. These were important to Twain, and, you know, I think he also didn't see how quickly they could disappear.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll get right back to this conversation with Andrew Beers. He's the author of Twain's Feast, and this conversation originally aired earlier this year. We're listening back to it as a celebration of American food now that the spring bounty is finally here. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm here with Andrew Beers. He's written a book about food in Mark Twain's America. It started with his discovery of a passage in one of Twain's memoirs where he's homesick in Europe and getting really, really, really sick of European food. So he is dreaming of his favorite American meals, and he just lists everything he wants to eat. Our guest recreated several of those dishes as faithfully as possible, which was difficult because in a lot of cases, the ingredients themselves had changed or disappeared. And you were kind of getting at that, right, Andrew?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can't just go out and, you know, prepare a Baltimore terrapin anymore. You know, these kinds of turtles, they've been hunted out. They're gone. So a lot of, in a lot of cases, I couldn't even attempt to recook these things. But when I could, I tried to source it as closely as I could and, you know, enjoy the same flavors that Twain did.
Having nothing to do with food per se, I find it really endearing that Mark Twain was so painfully homesick. I really think of him as this, like, tough guy. And there is something so vulnerable and sentimental about being homesick.
Yeah, you know, that's so true. And, you know, I grew up in Connecticut, and so I kind of grew up knowing that he had spent a lot of his years in Hartford, which I think is probably less known than his Missouri connection. But a lot of people think that the happiest years of his life, or some among them certainly, were the 10 years that he spent with his family in Hartford as a you know, family man. He had this wonderful home, and the meals there were kind of known far and wide for being kind of these wonderful, homey, but at the same time elegant meals. And he loved celebrating with friends and family and eating. And I think he just couldn't wait to get back to the U.S.
Have you ever experienced homesickness as a craving for a particular food?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot recently because, I mean, I'm in Northern California, and so I used to abalone dive. It's this kind of giant snail that you can go out and you dive for, and you get this one. It's just this spectacular kind of like rich, buttery flavor. And just in the last couple of years, those have completely disappeared. Like they're just gone. And so that's been really bringing me back to Twain and kind of thinking like, oh, well, did he see these things go? I mean, a lot of these foods were disappearing during his lifetime. I'm not sure how much he actually understood that or saw it in the moment. But I sure understand how like losing a food like that can be a blow.
Andrew Beers, let's get back to some of the foods from Twain's, like, nostalgic catalog. We focused earlier on foods he ate in Missouri and on the prairie, but part of what Mark Twain's list reveals is how well-traveled he was within the states. There are regional delicacies from everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he loved New Orleans. You know, he'd gone up and down the Mississippi as a riverboat pilot for years. I mean, there's foods from Connecticut where he raised his family, certainly from Missouri, San Francisco and Lake Tahoe, where he went as a young reporter and kind of discovered his writer's voice. I mean, you can really track his biography through the foods that he loved. I mean, he, you know, Philadelphia, where he worked as a printer's apprentice, everywhere.
Tell us about trout at Lake Tahoe.
Trout at Lake Tahoe is one of those things where you kind of think that you can reproduce the flavor and then you realize, oh, yeah, no, you really can't. Like, so trout at Lake Tahoe, there are still trout in the lake. You can go up, you can fish for them and cook them up, and you can cook them the way he would have eaten it. But when Twain was a young man at Lake Tahoe, the trout were these Lahontan cutthroat trout that could have weighed as much as, I think the record is 31 pounds. I mean, a 31-pound trout is just unimaginable. That's like an ocean-going salmon or something. You know, now if you catch a 5-pound trout, it'd be something to write home about. But that's what Twain experienced. He could see these trout through this clear water 100 feet down below his boat. And now those just aren't accessible. But there are efforts being made to bring them back. The Paiute Nation at Pyramid Lake are working on trying to restore some of those old trout because they were very important to the Native Americans in the area. And so there's a really serious effort being made to bring back those fish and thus that flavor.
And can you talk a bit about, I mean, even just the name of this chapter is like, what? Sheephead and croakers.
Right, sheephead. Yeah, that throws everybody a little bit. So sheephead and croakers were two of Twain's favorite fish from New Orleans. And that's an example of where you can see where he was and what he loved to eat, but also kind of what his position was in life. Because sheephead and croakers would have both been relatively inexpensive fish. You know, he's not necessarily talking about soft-shell crab or shrimp that would have been a whole lot of money. He's talking about something that he could have eaten in a more humble way. So sheep's head is a very bony fish that is absolutely horrifying to look at. I mean, if you've ever seen this thing, they've got a mouth of like three rows of human molars in them. I mean, it's just these horrific teeth. because they use them to crush up crab. I mean, they're bottom feeders and they eat crab and other shellfish.
And they don't brush.
They don't brush.
They
don't brush. There's no flossing.
Brush.
Exactly.
Ew.
But the good news is that gives their meat a really nice flavor of like crab and other shellfish. And so it's relatively cheap and inexpensive, but it can be prepared just wonderfully well. And so, yeah, I think that's what he was enjoying there. And then croaker, another small fish that he probably would have eaten just fried by the dozen on a platter. Kind of think of a golden fried crunchy fish. But again, very bony, like not that expensive. So it's something you'd sit down with friends at a meal to a big platter and kind of enjoy that with beer or wine. And
yeah, the beer and wine. I mean, you're in New Orleans, and I would think like with today's craft cocktail obsession, you might have learned something from what he drank alongside his sheep's head and croakers.
He definitely, champagne was a big thing back then, and definitely beer. I know that when he went back to New Orleans in 1885, he was amazed to see that there was an ice factory. That was a big thing for him. He was talking about, you know, the Arctic being relocated to New Orleans, which also tells me that in terms of craft cocktails and everything, when he was a younger man in New Orleans, it probably wasn't, the drinks probably weren't as cold as you might have hoped for.
You know, that does remind me that wasn't there like a lot of like fantasizing about cold, cold water in America?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ice water. He specifically, like, I know it's funny. It's like he said that it's like proper ice water in America. It should be like so cold it hurts your teeth. And then in Europe, you'd get this one little kind of semi-dirty piece of ice in a corner of the glass, and it was tepid and tasteless. I mean, he really got into the weeds on this stuff. He cared about the details.
And so, yeah, there's a lot of fish in this book, FYI, but like, so Mark Twain ate a lot of oysters and mussels in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And was he working at a newspaper in San Francisco? Is that right?
He was. That's really when he kind of broke out as a writer. You know, his first really famous piece that was published coast to coast was the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, which is in California's Sierra Mountains. And so, you know, he was almost taking like a trip outside of San Francisco. But when he was in San Francisco, he referred to the city as heaven on the half shell because of the feasts of oysters that you would have there. But like many of these other foods, they were just very, very different for him. I mean, now we sit down to these kind of big, sweet Kuramoto or Eastern oysters. The Olympia oysters that Twain knew in San Francisco, you have to think about them more as like the size of a bottle cap. You know, you can eat – he has these passages where he'd talk about eating – 100 oysters, 200 oysters, and you think, my God, how is it possible? But you might have been able to make an omelet with 100 oysters back then. They were tiny and really coppery. And so it was kind of the way you'd spend a whole long evening with friends is you have your champagne and you have your tiny coppery oysters, and you're going to spend a lot of time shucking them.
That sounds really fun. Am I romanticizing the situation?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it sounds great to me. You know, I mean, what's better than just kind of sitting around and drinking and joking and laughing over oysters, right?
So you have recreated a lot of things that Mark Twain would have eaten that he writes about in his book, like to the best of your ability. And I'm curious whether anyone has ever told you that this is kind of like Julie and Julia for dudes with facial hair in the farm to market scene.
Yeah, you know, the books came out almost simultaneously, and I kind of thought, oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely understand the appeal of Julie and Julia, right? I mean, you're going back and you've got these kind of like culinary role models and being able to kind of learn from them. It's great.
What has it been like to turn this project into a podcast with a comedian, Nick Offerman, as a collaborator?
Oh, it was so great. It was so much fun. I mean, you know, Nick has done the audiobooks for Tom Sawyer and for Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. And so he's a big Twain fan from going way back.
Yeah, he calls himself a Twainiac, which is not a thing I'd heard before.
Yeah, yeah. He just loves Mark Twain. And so when we sat down with him and started talking to him about this, it was just you could just feel his enthusiasm and kind of his interest right from the beginning. He just brought so much to it. You know, following his questions and his interests and also having people go out and revisit these sites 10 years later. I mean, a lot of the book has to do with change, right? Like change to the land, change to the American diet, all sorts of transformation. And so, you know, you could see how things have even just changed in the last 10 years. You know, I mean, when I wrote the book, there were a lot more oysters in the bay, and now there's kind of like there was a big flush of fresh water, so there's fewer. But anyway, it was just amazing looking at it through working on it with Nick. He's done a lot of writing.
I mean, do you
on
think
American
that the
history
change
himself.
Has, do you think the change has accelerated, or is it just that you're paying attention to it in that more micro kind of way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a lot of these big changes happened quite some time ago. I mean, if you want to talk about like prairie hens, you know, I mentioned before there were 14 million when Twain was growing up in Illinois. Now there's 300, and they have to bring those in from Missouri or from Minnesota. So, I mean, that's been kind of locked in for a long time. But yes, I do think that with things like the oysters, climate change and ocean acidification, I do think things are happening faster, unfortunately.
But back to this thing about recipes from literature, you do kind of have this really jam-packed paragraph of other literary cooking experiments you've conducted. And are there any that jump out that are not Twainian that you'd be willing to share that were sort of like taught you something along the lines of what you just learned hearing this this recipe for eggs and stuff?
What I think of is when I was a kid, I had a book that was the Little House on the Prairie cookbook, kind of the Laura Ingalls Wilder cookbook. And that was great. I mean, that I would definitely point listeners to that. It was just kind of this fantastic experience of, you know, eating American foods across that part of the country.
Did you try churning your own butter?
We have churned our own butter, but we don't actually have it. We don't churn it. But what my kids love to do is just take heavy, heavy cream, put it into a jar, and just shake the heck out of it for about 10 minutes, and you've got great fresh butter. Add a pinch of salt and a couple of fresh herbs like thyme or sage or something like that, and it's wonderful.
So that goes in the official recipe, shake the heck out of it?
Definitely. Sure.
Back to Twain, before we say goodbye, one of the intriguing tidbits here is that in this list of foods that he's fantasizing about in A Tramp Abroad, the list begins with radishes.
Right, I know. Twain always goes with something unexpected, right? So it's like the list is so full of like these rich, kind of unctuous, you know, buttery flavors, stuff that you kind of imagine having to go to sleep after. But he starts with this clean, crisp, kind of slightly peppery flavor. I mean, I love that about him. That he had an ability to appreciate things that were good in their own terms, right?
Yeah, he had also, you know, tomatoes. Just
right, tomatoes dressed with vinegar, I think, and salt, or you know, there was, you know, new rose potatoes roasted on the hearth. Sometimes it's like he almost runs away with himself, where he just says, you know, all sorts of southern breads or all sorts of pastries. You know, you can tell that there's this whole kind of litany or menagerie of breads or pastries that he'd love to get into, if only he had time.
With the radishes, I love this observation you have that. Clearly, he isn't listing these foods. He starts with radishes, so he doesn't just happen to be super hungry that day.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it feels more like a meditation to me, where he's just running through these things. It's not like you're exactly right. I mean, if he was just hungry, roast turkey is first, or porterhouse steak, or you know, something like that. But radishes, it's like, he's in a more contemplative mood. He's sitting back and remembering these places and these flavors that he's enjoyed through his life and seeing where they take him.
Okay, so let's end this conversation with cranberries. Talk to me about cranberries.
Oh, cranberries. Yeah, you know, one of the things that I tried to do was focus on wild foods, because those were a lot of the things that were very rooted in place for Twain. And cranberries, I found, had just been cultivated for the first time when Twain was in Twain's day. You know, they were basically a wild berry that people just figured out, hey, if you dump sand over them, they grow more strongly. It's kind of like a natural mulch or a natural pruning. And so they were kind of just entering the American diet as like a core Thanksgiving meal.
Can I just say, I'm really relieved that although it sounds like a lot of foods are disappearing, like it sounds like cranberries are more bountiful.
Yeah, cranberries are doing great.
Cranberries made a comeback.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Cranberries do, maple syrup. I mean, it's one thing that you really see here is that when people decide they want to care for something or bring it out, it's, you know, they can do it. And yeah, cranberries are Cranberries are doing great. There's still bogs all over Massachusetts, New Jersey, Wisconsin, but and they've really become, you know, a part of the American calendar. They're one of those truly seasonal foods for us, and it's just great to be able to share that kind of thing.
Andrew Beers is the author of Twain's Feast. It came out in 2011, but he has since turned it into a podcast with Nick Offerman. That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in to KCUR's Central Standard. You can check out anything you didn't catch from today's show or any of our past conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. If you missed yesterday's interview with the Indigenous artist making stop signs for her reservation, I definitely recommend that one. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, Kansas City's urban debate kids dominate nationwide. This year, kids from Sumner did especially well at a national competition in D.C. Why is that, and what's the tradition they're part of? That's tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.